It's poverty.
It's crime.
Unemployment.
Corruption.
Accountability.
The energy crisis.
Inflation.
We are worried.
That South Africa has myriad problems on all fronts is a given. But the time has come for us to look for real solutions. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and this MoneyWeb podcast will discuss those solutions on how South Africans can solve problems by having tough conversations and drawing on the insights of South Africa's top business leaders. Welcome to Fix SA. Welcome to another episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. You know the format. We look at issues beyond the challenges facing South Africa and hopefully try to explore practical solutions and insights from the nation's influential thinkers. In this episode, Roy Anderson, whose leadership journey began, I read, as a young artillery officer, and then he forged parallel careers in both the corporate and the military sectors. You'll also remember that he guided the Johannesburg Stock Exchange through its pivotal transition in the 1990s and then later served as chief executive of Liberty Life. Anderson's career, I think, offers valuable insight into leadership, particularly comparing the demands of commanding in the military to managing in business, emphasizing motivation, communication, planning, and discipline. Roy Anderson, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much indeed. South Africa, I would contend, and I'm sure you agree with me, needs so many things fixed. But fundamentally, it all comes down to leadership, style, and approach when solving problems. What have you learnt in that respect in your long career?
Leadership starts, of course, by setting the right example. But to me, the most important lesson I've learned about leadership is to have the correct team around you. If you can identify the right people, motivate them, ensure they have a shared vision, you'll be amazed at how much you can achieve. And then once you've achieved it, of course, you recognize them and you reward them. But it's all about what the team can do as compared to an individual.
Roy, obviously, depending on the task will determine how you're going to select that team. But again, in your experience, are there common traits that you look for in people who you would gather around you that would help you fix a certain problem?
Yes. Well, of course, you can't always guarantee that you can select your team, because when you move into a new position, you inherit a team, and it might take you some time to make your selection thereafter. But there are a couple of common traits. First of all, commitment. Commitment, energy, and of course, integrity. Without those, you will not succeed.
Why is energy in that respect so important, I wonder?
You know, a lot of people are 8-to-5ers, not everybody, but you want people who really are committed, who's prepared to go the extra mile. You know, when we restructured the JSE, you won't believe the effort that people had to put in to achieve that restructuring. And they often had to do it after hours and possibly at the expense of their private lives, but they had that absolute commitment to get the job done.
And that commitment, as you're suggesting to me, is also predicated on the other pillar that you've just raised, and that is motivation. How did you go about doing that?
Well, you sit down and you say to people, okay, where do we want to go? What is our goal? What is our vision? And you build a shared vision. I guess Rossi Erasmus is the classic topical example of that. But you have a shared vision and you get the buy-in. If you haven't got buy-in, forget it. You can't get anywhere. So it's all about sharing a vision and a commitment to get there. But, you know, people want to be part of a successful team. They actually seek your team eventually if they realize that this is a winning team.
How do you go about setting that shared vision? What are the building blocks in that respect?
I think the key thing is to say, what outcomes do we want? How do we make sure that this business or this entity is sustainable? And how do we want it to look in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Where do you think we need to be? And then, of course, what are the threats and what are the risks? I mean, take, for example, the post office or Kodak. Just look what's happened to them. Imagine if you were running a video shop. Where would you be today? So you have to think long term and you have to say, where do we want to be? And people will buy into that. In other words, they'll catch the excitement of where you want to be.
With Roy Anderson, I imagine the caveat that things change all the time. You have these so-called black swan events that you can't always set a path or chart a course, and it's going to remain constant. So you've also got to be flexible enough to change things. And maybe at some point in that journey, you've got to say, well, the outcome is going to be different.
Well, you know, we were taught as young lieutenants, every plan gets disrupted by the first round going off. Mm. Everything changes. The rules change. But it's very important that you're sensitive to the environment. Do you see these black swans? Of course, you can't see them all because by definition, they are black swans and they catch you by surprise. But you've got to continually think, what is going to happen in our industry? What are the threats? And equally importantly, what are our competitors likely to do? So you continually scan the horizon and you continually ask yourself the question, what do we need to do to ensure that this business remains sustainable?
Roy, it's also important to maintain a disciplined focus as far as fixing any problem is concerned or turning anything around. And I wonder if you could compare the role of discipline in the military compared to civilian leadership. Are there commonalities there and are there huge differences? And if so, what are they?
Well, first of all, let's just break that into two. Focus is vitally important. And the leader's job is to ensure continually monitoring the focus. How are we doing against the plan? Discipline is important. But, you know, I've always said to myself, the moment you have to discipline people, it means that maybe your leadership is failing. Either you've selected the wrong people or you haven't motivated them correctly. But, yes, there has to be discipline. There's that horrible expression that every company needs a good hanging. Every now and again, I don't like the expression and I don't like hanging. But eventually you have to discipline people in the corporate world if you really have to. But in the military, of course, it's far more instant. It's far more acceptable. But once again, I used to say to my young officers, if you have to discipline your troops, it means you failing as a leader.
So how do you go about, whether it be in the corporate or the military space, what is the philosophy in terms of discipline? Because other people, Roy, are also watching the process, and I guess that you don't want to demoralize them.
Now, the important thing is, first of all, at the beginning, is to set your expectations. In other words, your staff, be it in the military, be it in business, must know clearly what you expect. What are the rules of the game? What is acceptable? What isn't acceptable? What are the deliverables? And then you measure people against that. And you do it openly and honestly. And you say, look, you were supposed to do this 3 weeks ago. I can't see why you haven't done it. Therefore, I have to discipline you. But that's the stick. The carrot is equally important. Incentivize people to do the job.
So once you are on this journey in terms of fixing a company or fixing the country, obviously you want to achieve goals, but Roy, you are going to achieve those goals through immense pressure. How does one go about achieving those goals when the pressure is constantly ratcheting upwards?
Well, I guess I had one of the best baptisms of fire when I became CEO of the JSE. Because I had to get the acceptance of the staff, the brokers, especially the brokers on the floor, the media, and, of course, the new government of the day. And that put immense pressure on us, you know, to transform the stock exchange under all the spotlight of what was happening in the country. And it's a challenge. You've really got to apply your mind to it. And we were taught as young officers, there's a thing called loneliness of command. You can have good people around you, you can consult, but at the end of the day, the buck stops with you, and you have to have the resolve and the strength to be able to deal with it. So we were trained as young lieutenants on the concept of loneliness of command.
And how do you deal with that? Because loneliness of command, I would imagine, also can lead to deep thoughts of insecurity.
Yeah, it can. I think what you draw on is your inner resolve and your experience. I'll give you one war story. When we converted the JSE to the screen trading, we started with one share, then one sector. And in the end, the broker said to me, look, we can't continue splitting ourselves between the floor and the screen. And we went for sudden death. We put all the counters onto the JSE jet system. Well, the system crashed. The market closed. I had to phone the minister. I had to phone the governor of the Reserve Bank. Now, that's loneliness. That's pressure. But by 2 o'clock the next morning, fortunately, we got it up. But I had to show in front of my team that I had the inner strength not to panic. Obviously, inside there was a bit of turmoil, but I never showed it. I just showed strength. Similarly, in the army, if you, you know, if you get into a contact and you start taking casualties, you've got to show the strength.
And never show the weakness. So to go back to the swan analogy, for instance, you know, the swan can be paddling furiously underwater, but you've got to maintain a degree of, I guess, what, serenity, decorum, and a smile on your face.
Yeah, well, we were also told as young officers, you've always got to do things with dignity. Mm. Not always easy to be dignified when people around you let you down a bit.
So how do you overcome that? How do you maintain the moral high ground in that respect?
I think it's either in you. You've either got it or you haven't.
Ah, my next question then, Roy. Can you teach leadership?
Ah, yes, you can. Now, there are some people that are born leaders. You saw them at school, you know, the head boy or the person who was the captain of the first 15 or the first 11. They clearly had leadership. But defense forces specialize in training young leaders. When you take a young man or woman these days, fortunately, and you put them on an officer's course, you teach them how to lead. And then they, of course, learn by osmosis, by looking at the leaders around them. Now, you can teach leadership, although it comes more naturally to some people than others. There's some who just don't want to be leaders. Well, that's fine. That's their choice. They'll make a contribution in a different way.
And there are others who want to be leaders and are simply not up to the task.
Yeah, I think it was Montgomery who said, there's nothing more dangerous than a stupid officer who thinks he's clever.
Roy, in all of this, there are two other traits which I think are critical. One is the importance of adaptability. Again, to your reference a little earlier about everything changes when the first shot goes off. I'd be interested to know what your approach is towards adaptability. And again, bringing it back to the theme of this podcast, we're trying to fix so many things in South Africa. And I think sometimes we do fail on the front of adaptability. And then underpinning all of that is maintaining ethical standards. Again, something that we tend to cut corners on in this country.
Well, let's take those two separately. Adaptability, for me, being an accountant and a general, doesn't come naturally because you tend to get fixed on what you think is right and what is wrong. But the environment around you is constantly changing. Therefore, you've got to change. One way of handling it, of course, is to have some contingency plans. But as we said earlier on, you can't always foresee the black swan event. But you've got to have the ability to change your mind, to change the plan, and to say, okay, we were going this way. You have the equivalent of the halftime talk. We're going a different way. But ethics, on the other hand, not negotiable. If you don't have an ethical foundation in your company or your entity, you are lost, absolutely lost. Because the leaders at the top could be ethical, but if the people below them are not doing the right things, your company could well be destroyed. So you have to have this ethical base. And that's what worries me a little bit about the amount of working from home. Because when people work at home, there isn't this water cooler conversation. I learned as a young article clerk from my partners that I work for, this is the way we do things. There's no other way. We do it ethically. We do it properly. With people working from home, I just wonder if those messages and those learnings are being passed on properly.
Roy, how do you maintain ethical standards in an organization, or in this case, even a government?
Well, first of all, it starts with you. You cannot ask your people to be ethical if they see you not being ethical. If you, you know, have that champagne party in the middle of COVID, you are not going to be able to sell ethics. The way you've got to do it is to say, this is what we stand for. You've got to stamp on non-ethical behavior very quickly and very, very strongly. But you've also got to continually preach ethics. One of the banks that I was chairman of, they had a session during COVID where every Monday morning, the first half an hour, 20 minutes, was just on ethics. This is how this bank works.
Do you think we've lost direction of that in this country, the strict adherence to ethics? Or do you think that that moral backbone still exists, or perhaps it's hidden under a very fatty layer?
I think it's dissipating fairly quickly. And I'll start off with a silly example. People think it's all right to go through a red traffic light. Now, I know that's not necessarily ethics. That's just breaking the law. But that just indicates how people don't respect the law anymore, and they don't respect what is right. You know, my grandmother always said to me, do what is right. Now, I know that's trite and superficial, but she always says, do what is right. I'm wondering how many people are doing what is right, or they just see other people around them enriching themselves, and then they say, well, it's my turn now. So I think we do have a major ethical problem. We have two big problems in South Africa, ethics and education.
Let's talk about education in just a moment, but how do you right-size the ethics ship, do you think?
By having a very strong leader at the top who sets the rules, and then by proving that the rule of law works. I've been encouraged a little recently in the last month or two by the successes that the NPA is beginning to have. But you've got to actually show that the law has teeth, and you've got to show that the police force is honest and dedicated and will achieve results. But it's not a quick fix. There's no silver bullet. You just have to continually work at it.
I'm so glad that you raised the issue of education, and you're not the first leader in South Africa that I've spoken to on this podcast series that has stressed the importance of education. As far as you're concerned, though, the role of mentorship in developing future leaders is part of that educational mix. Where do you think the deficiencies are, Roy, and where do you start repairing that?
Well, let's just start off with education itself, and I'll move to mentorship. If I may name drop, the first time I met then Mr. Mandela, subsequently President Mandela, he came to the JSE, and after he'd spoken on the floor, we had a cup of tea together in my office, and he said to me, what do you think my main priorities should be as the incoming president? I said, without doubt, education. Now, he's not here to confirm it, but he agreed with me. And I think we fail. I think we're failing the youth of today. We're not giving them the tools, and consequently, there's a high unemployment rate. So there we have a problem. As far as mentorship is concerned, I have five mentees, five people that I meet with once a month, and often it's just a sounding board, and they talk to me about their career goals, the challenges they have preparing for a board meeting, the challenges that they have meeting the expectations of their bosses who they think are micromanaging or not giving them the support they need. Now, a mentor is not adding direct value by saying you should do A, B, C, D. You're listening to them, you're steering them, you're nudging them, and they blossom because they can see they actually solve their own problems in front of you, is my experience.
And these are all presumably people that could or would be or should be future leaders in South Africa, perhaps in the business space. What's the single biggest problem collectively do you think that they face?
Oh, there's so many problems. One is, I think, I hate to pick on this one, but there is cadre deployment. There are people being put into positions who don't necessarily have the skills and the background. And I think it's very unfair to them. So that it really should start off with people who have essentially the skills to do it. A classic example here, of course, is the municipalities. The municipalities are really battling because they're not staffed with councillors and management who have the right skills. First thing then, therefore, is to select the people with the right skills and then bring in training. I've always believed that you could bring in recently retired people and let them come in half a day a week just to provide advice and guidance, not in an arrogant way, but in a very supportive way. Mm.
Roy Anderson, part of effective leadership, and I guess part of fixing any problem, is also good time management. I'd be very interested to know how you manage the demands of what effectively was a dual career in the military and at the very highest levels of corporate South Africa. What was your approach, or maybe you even had a secret? I don't know.
Well, to be quite honest, I handled the strains of being an army officer rising to the rank of general and becoming a senior executive far easier than I managed my personal life, because there was often a similarity in the things I was doing, how I'd go about planning, how I could go about analyzing problems, etc. Those two worked well, other than, of course, when I got called up and disappeared for 3 months as we used to in the bad old days. That was a lot easier. I'm afraid the bit that suffered was my family life. Mm. If I look back and say, did I devote enough time to my wife and to my children? The honest answer is probably no, although I've got a very functional and lovely family. In retrospect, maybe it was more important to spend time with your children than to prepare for the next board meeting.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. And so many leaders I've spoken to have said exactly the same thing. Perhaps not in those words, but have certainly intimated it. Roy Anderson, I want to conclude this conversation by asking you this question. You have sat at the very top table in two very important sectors. You no doubt watch the progress of South Africa very, very closely. The name of this podcast is Fix SA. How confident are you about the short-term future of this country? And do you think the things that are wrong can be fixed to the benefit of all?
You know, I'm both positive and negative. On the positive side, I've seen recent signs of things coming right. I think the government of national unity, which nobody foresaw and probably would have chosen, means that I can see each of the ministers, whichever side they come from, seems to be performing better, have more energy, more enthusiastic. So there are those short-term benefits that I see there. To me, however, the biggest threat is the unemployment rate. How can we believe that we're going to be safe, secure, and prosperous when people are sitting in the so-called townships with no work and no hope? That's a ticking time bomb. So we have to actually create jobs, and we have to be absolutely dedicated and creative into how we're going to create jobs for this unemployed youth, typically. It's very unfair.
So just a quick one then. I said it was the last one, but let me throw one more in. It's all about creating jobs, but more importantly, it's about creating the enabling environment where jobs can be built. What do you think is that enabling environment that will create a smoother passage in that respect?
Well, in a way, we go back in a loop. Obviously, education will help, but that's a long-term one. But I think incentivizing employers would help. I think public works programs, we're going to be threatened terribly by a shortage of water. And we've got unemployed people. Why don't we put the people to work to sort out our dams, our rivers, etc.? And why don't we put these people to work to sort out our harbors and our railways? Now, I know these entities are meant to run at a profit, but isn't it better to have unemployed youth been giving challenges, opportunities, leadership, helping us to solve the problems of the future, rather than them sitting there getting more and more depressed and maybe even more and more irritable about the future of the country?
Roy Anderson, thank you very much for joining me on this edition of Fix SA. Thanks for listening to this Fix SA podcast. For more episodes posted every second Friday, go to moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.